Hello, and welcome to the Paul Cardall Podcast.
Did you know the best way to support your favorite musician is to bypass social media and go to their website and subscribe to their mailing list? Please show your support, particularly for our host. Go to Paul's website and subscribe. Visit www.paulcardall.com.
How are you, everyone? I'm so grateful that you're here for this episode of the Paul Cardall Podcast, which that's me. I love you and I thank you for being here. We're going to talk about a subject today that is not popular. If this is something that you don't want to listen to, I understand completely. Kind of a taboo subject. Definitely not something pop culture wants to go to and talk about because it's challenging. Grief is the intense expression for all these emotions we feel when we've lost somebody that we love. It's this journey that is long, that is difficult, that is hard. But I want to address this subject. Why? For all my career, since I started playing the piano, I've received countless messages, letters, emails about this topic because the music that God has blessed me with has been able to be part of this journey. And it's interesting because my career began shortly after my friend, Dave, passed away. We were in high school. He was a perfectly healthy human being. Here I was, having been born with only a single functioning ventricle, facing death my entire life, countless surgeries, very tender, sacred, beautiful moments with God because of the love I had been given by my family. You could feel God. And the beautiful thing is I came to understand why people have faith, because I developed faith. I needed faith in order to cling to this hope that there is something beyond the grave. When my friend tragically died in a auto pedestrian accident, you can imagine the emotions we all felt. Confused, shocked, and these are stages of grief that I want to talk about today. I want to walk you through these stages of grief. Some of you know what they are, but this is great review. And as we tried to process Dave's death, I went into my parents' living room, and there was the upright, quiet piano that I hadn't really touched since I took piano lessons as an 8-year-old. My piano teacher told my mom I was wasting her time and my mom's money, and I was a restless kid who didn't want to practice. And so after 6 months, I think a year, I had done one recital, and that was the end of playing the piano. But I loved music, and when I met Dave, he could sit at the piano and play Billy Joel, Elton John. He would entertain us. He'd play that heart and soul, and I would watch people gather. And I looked at him, and I was mesmerized by how he'd play. And I wanted to be able to do that because I loved that type of music. I was into artists like Yanni. We all know Yanni. He would flip his hair back and people would scream in excitement with how he played the piano. There was an artist, John Schmidt, who's now in the Piano Guys. He became a friend, a mentor, people like Kurt Bester. I love these artists and I would listen to them and I wanted to be able to play the piano. Well, as I sat there contemplating Dave's death and trying to ask, why am I still here? I have all these medical issues and you've kept me alive, God. Why? But in that process, I sat there at the piano and I pounded out anger, frustration. I just pounded on the keys, and that's a very healthy thing I recommend you do in grief. But then I slowly hit tenderly calmly a couple notes. The tone spoke to my soul. It was such a beauty in the way that I tenderly hit each note. I felt God tell me everything is going to be okay. Well, day after day, I'd sit at the piano, and in processing what had happened to all of us at the high school and losing Dave and myself, I would create. The piano was a puzzle. It was life. How do you put the pieces together and try to bring harmony and understanding, melody, orchestra, something gorgeous out of all these difficult things? And I began to create music. And I went and I shared the song with Dave's parents. His father cried, his mother, of course, but to see his father cry, they called the neighbors, invited people to come over. They said, play it again. They had me play it even once more. And when people are asking you to play it again, there's this internal feeling of gratitude, vindication for the realization that God has given you a gift. And, you know, the whole podcast that I do, it's been about understanding our gifts and how they've helped shape our purpose in life. And it was going through grief that helped shape my career as a musician. And I think that's why the music has helped so many of you. And it's amazing. Millions of people all over the world have these individual, intimate experiences with the music. It's not something that groups come together and, you know, have this wonderful big experience. It's a individual one-by-one experience. I believe God knows who is hurting. And he knows what you need at that time. Could be a comedian, could be a film, could be a neighbor, could be a friend, could be your parents, your siblings, just listening to you, not talking to you, but listening to you. And of course, music, our bodies, you know, we're made up of, I think, 80% water, and it's been clinically proven certain types of music sends this vibration to our body and we feel things. And the music I've been fortunate and blessed to do boosts the immune system, reduces stress and anxiety, and helps people process their trauma. So I want to walk you through the stages of grief. I have composed a song called A Grief Observed. This came to me in the night. I came to the studio here and I started to work it out. And then I produced it and recorded it. And it's available. It's inspired by this process, and more particularly, a book by C.S. Lewis, one of the most recognized theologians from Oxford University. He wrote a book called A Grief Observed. When it first came out, it did not come out under his name. He was embarrassed by the fact that he was so raw in writing this book, because it was about the passing of his wife. The death of his wife evoked so many emotions because he started to question God, wonder, how can you do this to me? How can you do this to my wife, Joy? Isn't that interesting? Interesting that his wife's name was Joy. She was the joy of his life. But in her passing, he had this wrestle with God. And so he wrote this series of emotions, journaling his feelings and wrestle with God. So we'll talk briefly about that book, go into a little depth. So again, welcome to my podcast. I would love you to subscribe to this. You can subscribe wherever you're listening right now and leave a review. Please leave a comment. And of course, recommend this to somebody you know who would appreciate and feel encouragement from listening to these guests that I've had, and even this one, where there are no guests, and we walk through this journey of talking about grief. I've got some notes, so if you're watching on YouTube, I'll be looking up and going through some of these things. Well, I've done a lot of research, and majority of the psychologists suggest that the leading concern with delving into grief is because it may bring up our own unresolved feelings or fears about our mortality. And when it comes to knowing someone grieving, many of us have a fear of saying the wrong thing or unintentionally causing more distress. Also, there are cultural and religious factors. Theology, which is the study of doctrine, and everybody has their different type of study and knowledge from culture, traditions, the faith that you associate with, the denomination you support and attend, or those of you that are close to God but and have you feel like you have this relationship with the Lord, but you've chosen not to attend any particular faith. So I approach this with humility. I approach this with a desire to learn together about grief, the process of losing somebody we love. And of course, you know, we are not going to get out of this world alive. We will also approach this stage. And Russell Brand wrote this book, and he begins it with chisel, 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 our names on a stone. And it had him reflect through the 12 steps program of what he needed to do to get his life in order, to prepare, because like I mentioned, when you talk about death, there are unresolved feelings that come to all of us. We self-examine ourselves. There's a beautiful verse of scripture that says, examine yourselves. And another one, which I really admire, let virtue garnish thy thoughts unceasingly. This is not easy. Our lives are challenging. We have a lot of chemical imbalances, a lot of consequences that come to us as a result of our actions, and we're affected by the consequences of other people's actions. But we're all in the sandpile together. We're all learning how to get along. God is watching. He is close. He finds joy in us. He cries with us. That is something I believe, and we'll get into that a little bit more. Now, I respect your beliefs, and I think when we talk about these things, we can reason together with one another, come to an understanding of what other people believe in order to have respect for their journey. So let me walk you through these stages of grief, and it's really powerful stuff. So understanding there are five stages of grief, and you may have heard of these five stages, but what are they, and does grief really follow a set time frame? Are these five stages something you go through? Okay, here's one, now here's the next one, all the way to five, and then, then we're done with those stages. Well, the fact is, these are emotions that will come and go, not in the order that I talk about. So the question is, who developed these five stages of grief? Where do they come from? Well, the five stages of grief model was developed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and became famous after she published her book on death and dying in 1969. So Kubler-Ross, she developed her model to describe people with a terminal illness facing their own death. But it was soon adapted as a way of thinking about grief for all of us in general. So the five stages, what are they? The First one is denial. And of course, this comes and goes with all of us. Denial. Feeling numb is common in the early stages and after bereavement. Some of us at first carry on as if nothing has happened. Even if we know with our heads that someone has died, it can be hard to believe that someone important, someone we love, they're not coming back. So it's also very common to feel the presence through this process of someone who has died, to hear their voice or to even see them. Now, according to your faith, traditions, or beliefs, this could vary in whether you believe this is real or, as psychologists suggest, science always suggests, but I believe God vindicates science, is that these may be, in fact, real experiences. Hearing a voice of reassurance, seeing briefly them, a experience of reassurance that you can have that hope that you will be reunited. So denial is an interesting thing. Now, I want to share briefly one of my personal stories. I mentioned earlier about my single functioning ventricle losing my friend Dave. Trying to understand why this was happening. Well, years later, around the age of 32, I developed heart failure. And, you know, my wife, my daughter, I did not want to die. I created a blog called Living for Eden. This was something my goal was to do, to live so that my daughter will have a father. They listed me for a heart, which would be very complex because my anatomy was not normal. It would take a specific surgeon associated with working on children with abnormalities in their heart, defects, basically kids born with congenital heart disease, the number one cause of infant-related deaths, and, interestingly enough, the least funded of all major diseases, all major chronic illnesses. So it would take a gifted surgeon, and I was on the transplant list, and many of you know that it took 385 days, and I did receive a donor heart. God orchestrated this beautiful miracle. And over the years, the feeling of guilt has come and gone. People I love who were listed for transplants didn't make it. And here I was, alive. But while I waited for my heart, my younger brother, who was working on his doctorate at Northern Arizona State University, he was working in a field called ecological genetics. He was a brilliant human being, made a lot of contributions to the advancements in genetic study within the environment. And I could go on and on about my brother, but he suffered from some form of mental illness. He was diagnosed as bipolar. And he would have these episodes, not all the time. This was rare when he would have these episodes, usually when he was working on his bachelor's and then his master's and now his PhD. And unfortunately, he had an episode and it led to his death. This was 9 months into me waiting. Previously, that December, before that, my family gathered at my grandparents' home. Being born in the LDS tradition, we would have blessings where there was a laying on of hands, and usually a patriarch would offer up a blessing, being a father, a grandfather. And in this case, all my siblings were there, their husbands, my brothers with their wives. Brian was there, and we gathered in this circle, and I sat in the chair.
And my brothers, my grandfather, my father, gave the blessing that somehow a miracle would happen, that I'd be able to get a heart. And who would have known that by the time I received my heart, my brother, Brian, who was in that room with us, that we were not blessing, we were not praying for, he passed away. And shortly after I received the heart, my grandfather, a World War II veteran, just in this incredible, wonderful man who taught us to believe, to work hard, to respect people, to be kind, he passed away as well. So here I was at my brother's funeral with an oxygen tube on me. I had medicine going into me intravenously. Some of these medical terms are always difficult for me to pronounce. But I had a tube going into my vein with medicine being pumped into it. And I looked, because I was like I was dying, and yet I stood next to my brother's coffin and shook the hands against the advisement of my doctors, who wanted me to stay healthy, to avoid crowds. But I shook the hand of, oh man, the line was so long. Friends of my parents, relatives, people that had read about the story, and they came, I shook their hands. And interestingly enough, prior to that, when it came on the news about my brother dying, they said the son of Dwayne Cardall, because my father was a broadcast journalist for many years. People know him in Utah as the religion reporter. He traveled all over the world reporting and about religious experiences associated with Utah and the LDS Church. So it came across the radio that the son of Dwayne Cardall had died. And people knew me because of my music, and they didn't say the first name of my brother. So at home, I was waiting for my transplant, sitting in my overstuffed chair with the oxygen tube, waiting for that call for the doctors to say they found a heart. But instead, I got the call from my father. And when it was that my brother had died, and then when it came over the air, we started getting messages on our answer machine telling my wife at the time, "We're so sorry. We're so sorry. What can we do?" So here I was hearing what people would have said had I passed. Can you imagine? Can you imagine being in that situation, listening to messages of people who love you? What would they say? Fortunately, at the time, I was a pretty good guy and did my best. Loved people, did all I could, and they were saying kind things. Of course, they loved my wife more than they loved me. They loved my daughter. But I was in major denial, because why would the Lord that I had come to understand through tradition, through experiences, why would he do this? Why would he take my brother? Why not me? So again, like Dave, my friend, why would he take my brother? So I was in a lot of denial, which led to this next stage. And this is a stage that still comes and goes. Anger. When you've lost somebody, you've been angry. And that emotion often has been told to us, you shouldn't feel anger towards anything. Well, we need to be angry. It is healthy. It is an emotion we need to process. So, you know, it's a natural emotion, and very natural after somebody dies. Death can seem cruel and unfair, especially when you feel someone has died before their time or had plans for the future together. My brother was working on his PhD. He left God took him, and he left his wife, their beautiful 2-year-old,
and his wife was pregnant. Now, again, negotiating, denial with God, anger. I also, at the time, you know, married, and I had a daughter. So it was a similar situation, yet my brother was killed. So I got angry, really angry. Our family got angry because the situation was an accident. It could have been prevented had certain people had training in how to deal with these circumstances. And with the circumstances, it could have been prevented. So the other thing, it's also common, and I was never angry at my brother, but it's also common to feel angry towards the person who has died. And in the event of suicide or, you know, even elderly people, like, why did you leave me before I left you? I need you. I want you here. You start to get mad emotionally, internally towards that person for leaving. These are normal emotions. And also the big one, haven't you felt anger for yourself for not having spent more time with that person? We start to think, what could I have done better? What could I have done to improve my relationship before they passed? And as I'm talking, I'm thinking to myself, these experiences should teach us what we need to do, knowing what we've experienced. So, you know, that's not easy. We still have relationships. They might not always be as close as we want them to be. And I once heard a great man, Howard W. Hunter, say, yeah, this was in the 80s when he said this, and yes, I was alive in the 80s. He said, think about that letter you didn't write, that call you never made. The impact it has when you do, you know this, you felt this, when somebody out of the blue calls you to say, I'm thinking about you, I love you, what can I do for you? And this before somebody you know has passed. The next thing we do is we start bargaining. You know, we negotiate with ourselves, with God. You know, when we're in pain, it's sometimes hard to accept that there's nothing we can do to change this. Bargaining is when we start to make deals with ourselves, or perhaps with God. If we're religious, we want to believe that if we act in a particular way, you know, we'll feel better. Maybe if I do everything that my faith has asked me to do, I'm going to be healed from this. God is going to heal my heart. If I do everything my therapist tells me to do and I work through this, I'll be healed. These are the things we feel. And even though there is truth to this, in those early stages of grief, we are bargaining. It's common also to find ourselves going over and over things that happened in the past and asking a lot of what if questions, wishing we could go back and change things. Like I said, in the hopes that we could have had this thing turn out differently. You know, what could we have done? And again, a personal insight. And I share these personal insights because I want to draw on my experiences and other to, in order to hopefully help you process what you've experienced as well. Shortly before my brother passed, this was a few days before, my parents picked me up. I couldn't really drive at the time. They did give me a handicap pass, which was good because I could go to Costco and get front row parking, you know, or if I wanted to go to a Utah Jazz game, I was living in Utah, I'd get front row parking. Of course, I didn't go out much, but I thought, handicap sticker, that's awesome. I get front row parking. This is great. But my parents picked me up to take me to a baseball game of a family member. And my parents that night were supposed to go to a wedding. So we're in the car and Brian calls and he's talking to my parents, and my parents are, you know, saying we've got Paul, we're worried about Paul, you know, he's tired, we need to get him back, not sure if we're going to make it to this wedding. And I heard my brothers say, well, you need to take care of Paul. Paul's, you know, please take care of Paul. Well, my parents decided to go to that wedding, and I'm so glad they did, because that night, that was the last night that they saw Brian. So, you know, my parents might even be listening to this podcast. I don't know when they do, but I can't imagine what they've gone through. The journey they have walked, and, you know, these are private experiences they've walked through. My dad being a public figure in Utah, many people know the story, and they know my story. So it's been made public. And so I share it, mom and dad, with respect and love and hope that as people go through these stages, that what I'm talking about can help. The other thing is, we sink into the next stage, or this stage comes and goes. Depression, sadness, and longing are what we think of most often when we think about grief. So this pain can be very intense and come in waves. It can come in waves over many days, many months, many years. So life can feel like it no longer holds any meaning. And that can be very scary. When we sink into a depression, we also kind of go through these other stages of denial of things we believe. We start to try to understand, why is it that I believe this? We start to clear off the table of everything we know in life, and then start to rebuild. This is something I've done, and I've been very sincere, honest, and raw in trying to rebuild what it is I believe. And in that process, I've been on my knees praying, and because I'm a big believer in scripture, pouring through scripture to understand. And I feel like this wrestle I've had with God, I become closer to him, because I know ultimately he is the source of love, and feeling that love doesn't necessarily completely heal us here in this life, but what it does is it gives us that hope and this internal assurance that we need to be able to move forward. These emotions are going to come and go, and the reason it comes to my mind right now, and you're probably thinking this as well, the reason we must go through this stuff is because it stretches us. In order to know love, intense love, we have to suffer. We have to go through pain. Why do these things happen? Again, negotiating, bargaining, in our understanding. In my own understanding, it comes to the point where it's not, you know, why is this happening? It's, what am I supposed to learn from this? What am I being taught? And that leads to another stage, acceptance. And they say this is the final stage, but again, even after you accept the reality of what this is and how it's happened, you go back to these other stages. It comes and goes. On birthdays of the person, the past, we celebrate them. We talk about it on social media for those that are not afraid to be totally private. We celebrate it with family, you know, the passing of their death. You know, and in the process of acceptance, I recall when I was in the hospital and my brother had already passed. I'm in the hospital. I'm listed for that heart. I'm kind of near the top of the list, and they're just waiting, the medical team, to find out, you know, is there something available? And I'm in there trying to process, you know, for me to live, someone has to, an organ donor has to die. Now, walking through those shoes, how do I live knowing somebody has died, somebody's son, somebody's daughter, somebody's brother, somebody's father. And in the process of acceptance of the fact that I needed to get a heart transplant and knowing somebody was going to die, I asked my brother, Craig, my youngest brother, to bless me according to the tradition of my faith. And Craig laid hands on me and said, because somebody has selflessly accepted that in their death, they can be an organ donor, that they've signed up to sacrifice the organs they no longer need, because of them, you'll be able to live a little longer. But then he said something really profound that strengthened my belief, my faith. It just really stretched me, my understanding in my own walk with Jesus Christ. And whether you believe him or not, the story is intense. My brother said to me, because of Jesus Christ, who laid down his life, the greatest organ donor of all, spiritually and physically, because of him, all of us, not just you, all of us will receive new life, not just temporarily, but forever. So through my organ donor, I'd be able to live a little longer. Through the eternal physician, creator of this vast cosmos that we live in, who knows our beating hearts because of his sacrifice and his death, we'll all live forever. And that really helped me to start to accept my own reality. So acceptance, you know, grief comes and goes like the ocean waves that hit the shore. Sometimes there's a higher tide and more intense ocean wave crashing in, as we've seen as we've driven along Pacific highways and, you know, along the Atlantic highways, and you see those waves crash in. Sometimes it's very calm. It can feel like, you know, nothing will ever be right again. But gradually, as I experienced, most people find that the pain eases. I know, you know, does it feel to you like in your process that it's like they've amputated half your body? You it's gone, but you still feel like it's right there. So we'll never get over the fact that somebody precious to us has passed, but we can learn to live with it, just like any amputee. So we want to keep their memories alive. We want to preserve their legacy. There's so many stories I could go on and on. I want to give a shout out, and I don't know if that's the most respectful way to do it, to my sister Jane and her brother Mike. They lost their son. And it's been incredible to watch my sister in her process of grief and the way she's accepted it by serving other people. Unfortunately, he was a boy who drowned. And she has been able to encourage and help probably thousands of parents in interviews that she's done with certain organizations, and talking about it, and the celebrations she does every year where Sunshine for Jalen. She's been able to help thousands of people be encouraged to teach their kids how to swim. And it's amazing, because you think after that experience that she wouldn't want her other kids to go swimming, but they've embraced it. They get swim lessons and they are out there in the water as a family. Here's a beautiful picture, actually, of all of them together, and they're swimming with dolphins. So shout out to my sister, Jane. You're awesome. I love you. The experience you've gone through has taught all of us to have sunshine in our hearts. Well, through all this process, you know, a lot of my music, particularly from my New Life record, and my latest return home is through this process, you know, life and death, Gracie's theme, these new songs on my album Return Home, about stories of our ancestors, the land of our ancestors, immigrant ships, Ljubljana, which is where my wife's family is from, suffered many challenges of loss. Well, that leads me to this discussion about C.S. Lewis. Now, I don't know what you know about C.S. Lewis, but oh my gosh. He is a man who was an atheist. He did not believe in God, but through a series of experiences, he came to believe in God, and it brought perspective to his life. So he became this incredible theologian at Oxford University, and he would have these discussions with his colleagues. You know, one of his colleagues was Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. They would all have these discussions, and Tolkien was a Catholic man, and you can see Catholic themes throughout The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and C.S. Lewis was an Anglican, and in his books, Narnia, you see kind of the difference of these two faiths. They are powerful stories of journeys to do noble things, but they differ in the way that the evil is portrayed and the good is portrayed. So it was April 1956 when C.S. Lewis came to this woman, Joy Davidson, a popular American writer. He came to her rescue. He had fallen in love with her. They had this beautiful romance. She was trying to get her visa to be in Britain to do more work. She loved the writings of C.S. Lewis, and he came to the rescue and helped her get a visa. And in the process, they fell in love. And because she had divorced, there was elements back then where the church would not let them have a church marriage, blessed by God according to their beliefs. So they had a civil marriage, but neither of them, because of their faith, believed it was a real marriage, which is interesting. It was merely a legal agreement that enabled Joy to become a British citizen. Well, Lewis continued to live in Oxford as a bachelor before they married. And she continued to live as a single mother as they were courting one another. But in 1956, Joy, I love that name because I have a grandma, Joy, but Joy was the joy of C.S. Lewis' life. He was a 56-year-old man, been a bachelor all his life, teaching people the meaning of pain. And yet he had never been married. So he fell in love with her, and she developed cancer. She was diagnosed as having bone cancer. So as she was dying, their great desire, Lewis and Joy, was to have a real marriage, to be blessed by the church so that the two of them could live as man and wife. Because their belief was in civil marriage that they could not live together. This was something their faiths were teaching them. But if they could have a real marriage blessed by God, they could live together as man and wife. I always find this very fascinating. But she was in the hospital and she was dying. So how could they finally eventually live together? Well, they wanted to be blessed by the church. And so they got the response. They were enabled to do that. And they had a hospital bedside wedding. It was performed on March 21st, 1957. And though she was essentially released from the hospital in order to die at home, the cancer went into remission, much to everyone's surprise. And they had the joy of a bliss marriage for a season. It was the mercy and grace of God. But then, of course, she passed away. So C.S. Lewis, in trying to process why the love of his life was gone, he went through all these stages of grief, and he was so angry at the Lord. He calls it
wrestle with God. He began to journal his thoughts. And eventually, all of these thoughts came together as this book, A Grief Observed. And going through this, he thought, even like I am here today with this podcast, he needed to get that out. The publisher came to him and said, this is amazing. You need to publish this. Well, he didn't want people to know it was him because it was very vulnerable and raw. And he had this prestige. You know, he is the professor from Oxford, this noble, strong man, a pillar for God. But it was so vulnerable and raw that he wanted it printed under an alias. He didn't want people to know it was him. And it actually was published briefly like that. But eventually, because of the result, they republished it under his name. And people were, yeah, I mean, the book remains one of the biggest selling books on death. Now, before I go into the book, I do want to read you this poem he wrote for his wife. This is so beautiful. He says, this is a poem called As the Ruins Falls. As the Ruin Falls. All this is a flashy rhetoric about loving you. I never had a selfless thought since I was born. And I am mercenary and self-seeking through and through. I want God, you, all my friends, merely to serve my turn. Peace, reassurance, pleasure are the goals I seek. I cannot crawl an inch outside my proper skin. I talk of love. A scholar's parrot may talk Greek, but self-imprisoned always end where I begin. Only that now you have taught me, but how late, my lack, I see the chasm, and everything you are was making my heart into a bridge by which I might get back from exile and grow, man. And now the bridge is breaking. For this I bless you. As the ruin falls, the pains you give me are more precious than all other gains. This was a man who admitted he was selfish. He wanted the attention. He loved adulation. But when he met her, his heart crumbled and crushed. She melted his heart in her death, crushed his heart. Then he began to wrestle with God, who made his heart, to understand his heart. So I just want to give you some summary of ideas from his book before we end. And my song, A Grief Observed, I was thinking about this book as I wrote that piece. It's not super melodic. It just kind of lies there. A cello comes and goes. A pedal steel guitar, I thought that was appropriate, comes and goes. But the piano, this light touch of the piano, the buildup, this is A Grief Observed. And I hope you listen to it and share it. So a summary of key ideas from A Grief Observed. So C.S. Lewis dives deep into the experience of loss and grief during the aftermath of Joy's death. He begins by expressing the disorienting shock and pain that grieving can often bring about, comparing it to fear. While grieving, Lewis found himself doubting his faith, wrestling and questions about God's existence, and questioning why such suffering had to be endured. There's a phrase he said in the book that is very profound. He says,
Why is it in the process of dealing with death that every time you go to knock on the Lord's door, nobody comes to the door? And then he goes and he sees something in the window. The window's open and he looks in, but then the window shutters are slammed in your face. He's trying to reach God, but he feels completely abandoned. So he experiences grief like a valley, himself as a traveler lost within a foggy valley. You know, a mist of darkness comes over him. He feels disillusioned by his intellectual understanding of suffering, which now, amid personal loss, seems insubstantial. And he finds himself wrestling with God's role in his wife's death and the significance of pain in the human experience. So he plunges deeper into this feeling of grief. He begins to inspect the nature of human suffering more closely. This is a very educated man that, like a scientist, dissects human emotions. So he contemplates whether our sorrows and pain might even serve. Do they serve as tools for God to shape and to mold us? So he muses on the concept of divine omnipotence and wonders whether we as humans may be interpreting the notion of an all-powerfully God too literally. He starts to question the imagery we often attribute to God, like a magnifying reflection of our human fathers. I mean, he's going deep into it. He acknowledges the complexities of human suffering, rejecting the simplistic view that wrongs are punished and virtues are rewarded. So he's saying that even if I do right, why are these pains still here? I cannot work my way out of the grace of God. I cannot work my way into heaven. So the main question now is why such intense suffering is necessary for human spirituality at all. What's the point? So gradually Lewis begins to find glimpses of understanding amidst his debilitating grief. You felt this. He confesses that his previous perceptions of God were too fixed, too human-like. By exploring his raw grief, Lewis depressurizes his deep-seated anxieties about existence. His spiritual ambiguity begins to lift as he revisits memories of his wife, joyous and fond. He finally accepts the reality of his wife's death and understanding it is part of life. It's the deal. Rather than rejecting his feelings of sorrow, he embraces them as indications of deep love that he held for his wife. Again, when people die, we had no idea the depths of the love we had for this person. And often it's too late. And this is part of the stage of grief, bargaining, denial, anger. So C.S. Lewis in this book nears resolution. I think any of us that want to dive deeper into this should read A Grief Observed. So moving towards the conclusion of the book, Lewis begins to recognize that his faith has not been shattered, but rather refined by his suffering. He realizes that pain is instrumental in the process of spiritual growth. By embracing his suffering, he learns that it is through hardship that we often best gain wisdom. And in the end, A Grief Observed works as Lewis's personal reconciliation with his grief and faith. So the probing questions he encountered on his journey led him to address the universality of suffering. It led him to be really, you know, why is this? Why does everyone experience this? This is a global thing, like a pandemic. Acknowledging his pain, you know, it's just part of the human condition. This is something everyone experiences. So his insightful reflections paint a detailed portrait of a man wrestling with grief, providing comforting companionship for others embarking on a similar journey, which is what his book does, which is what I hope this podcast is doing, in which my music, particularly this song, A Grief Observed, can do for you. I hope as we walk through this delicate subject that you've been able to process some things in your own journey. You've thought about things. And if there are things you've been, you know, that have swelled up inside of you of things you're thinking you need to do, do them. Do them. Make a list. Make a list. Think about this again. Maybe listen to this again. Write a list. Maybe when you're listening to A Grief Observed or any of my music, make a list of things that you want to do. Now, those things are not going to take away the pain, as we've discussed, but it will definitely help you in the journey think through it. C.S. Lewis journaled. When you go to a therapy session or anybody, you learn that journaling is the best way to process emotion. It's one of the most effective ways. I grew up in a faith where it was like, not necessarily a commandment, but it was highly advised to write a journal. And in the journal, you can really just lay down in an organized or unorganized way what you're feeling. And if you go too intense and really just vent out in your anger, like you can rip up the piece of paper and throw it in the fire, throw it in the garbage. But you've been able to go through that process. One of the podcast episodes we're going to be doing is with my friend Luke, who gives training and lessons on how to journal. If you don't know how to journal, this may be somebody that can guide you through it. There's a podcast episode coming up about that. If you're listening to this in the future, go back to my website, paulcardall.com, click on the podcast link. You'll see all of the guests I've had, all of the episodes, or you can do this on any of the platforms you listen to. So thank you everybody for joining me again. I appreciate, I love you. We can walk through this process of life together. Whatever you believe, I respect you. I admire you. I'm a big believer in Jesus. And I think the true Christian is anyone who is bearing fruit. By their fruits, ye shall know them. Fruit is delicious. It is wonderful. Originally, it was the dessert everyone would have. You know, an apple, a pear, plums, peaches, before the man-made sugar candies came in, the ice creams, and so bear fruit. We're not perfect. A lot of times the fruit I bear is rotten. People think it's rotten. It's the effort that counts. It's getting back up again and going out and doing your best. You are loved. God loves you. And we'll talk next time.
When we listen to someone's story and ideas, we build bridges to connect with others. When we allow ourselves to see someone else's point of view, it minimizes arguments and disagreements. Please show your support by subscribing to the Paul Cardall Podcast, along with leaving a review. For more information, visit www.paulcardall.com.